Mormon Stories Podcast is made possible through the financial contributions of its listeners. To keep it alive and available to future generations, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org. All right, Carrie, well, let's bring you into this. Now, Carrie, it's been a couple years since Proposition 8. Where are you? You're a BYU student, right?
Yes, I am.
What year are you?
I'm a Cougar.
Go Cougars.
I'm a senior. Yeah, go Cougars.
Okay, so you're a senior at BYU. What in the world, 2 years after Prop 8, made you decide that you wanted to write a letter to the editor?
It was two things, really, that were the immediate cause of me wanting to write this letter. One was an editorial printed in BYU's newspaper that kind of only peripherally mentioned Proposition 8, but it was basically the author's point was that because he was following God's counsel and he had done his marriage correctly, that God was blessing him with children, and that although the world might disapprove, that felt to him like a pretty obvious sign of God's approval of his choice to be married when he chose to be married, and in the situation he was in, he was citing a article that had come out saying that most marriages that occurred later in life were more successful than earlier marriages. There's many times I've read, as kind of the irony of my letter being removed for being offensive, is that I don't know if I've ever read a more offensive viewpoint newspaper than what happens in the Daily Universe almost every week, in my opinion, as to opinions that people express that feel just mean-spirited or cocky, I think is a good word, as to the opinions that they're expressing in kind of blatant disregard for the morality of people outside of the BYU community. So that was one impetus. And the other was just reading all of Judge Walker's decision. I read the entire 138-page decision, and reading it, it was a revelation. There was a burning in the bosom. There was, he makes a comment in his decision where he says, he points out that the proponents of Proposition 8 never called a witness who would explain the discrepancies between the arguments used to promote Proposition 8 during the campaign and those used during the trial. And I might have misinterpreted what he was saying, but I took that as he was anticipating that would be part of the trial. And I also was kind of surprised that nothing had been said on those points that were being promoted so aggressively. And so after I'd read that decision, I decided, you know, I needed to finally go back to one of these five letters to the editors I'd started in the past and finish one of them and send it in. And so I did it. I did it just in the middle of a class, sat down and wrote it.
So you wrote that during a class on a laptop?
Yes.
Okay. And so just tell us, you know, the main points of the article again.
The main point of my article is kind of what I just said. It's just that, that during the trial, I mean, during the campaign, there were many arguments that claimed to be rational and non-religious as to why Proposition 8 should be passed in California, that none of those arguments appeared in the trial. Although some of them did, there were the argument of preserving the definition of traditional marriage was addressed in the trial. And according to the evidence and the judge's opinion, it was found that the definition of marriage had changed already before in the past with no direct negative consequences. They talked a lot about coverture, which I don't know, that might be a little, that's out of my legal expertise. But what I understand is that marriage used to mean that the woman and the man became one entity before the law, I think financially and legally. and that that had since been changed, and that was a fundamental change in the definition of marriage, and that it was seen as a positive step for society. But besides that, a lot of the arguments weren't addressed, a lot of these arguments that Morris has talked about. And I felt like it was a sign that those weren't the real arguments that people who supported Proposition 8 inside the LDS Church, that wasn't why they had supported it. And I mean, that was largely based off of just talking to people. One thing that's been, I think, most misunderstood about my letter is that it was really addressed to the BYU community. It was addressed to BYU students. Some of my language, I think, included a more general audience, but I definitely didn't anticipate that people would be reading it all over the country. And even I've gotten some feedback from people in Australia and Europe who've read the letter as well. And so definitely, I think, in the BYU community, at least, that which a lot of times is a microcosm of greater Mormonism, that people were supporting Proposition 8 because the prophet had told them so. And I felt like they should be honest about that. That's a stance that, while it might not be respected by other people, it wasn't offensive to them, and it was true. And I felt like if that it's within Mormon experience to sometimes have to take a unpopular stance for a religious reason, and that people should take ownership that that is what they were doing, and that it was, and not hide behind things that seem to be false.
You know, it's kind of weird, Kerry, because on the one hand, your final point is very true blue. It's like for once. You know, not for once, but it's basically a Mormon saying, let's follow the prophet, or we follow the prophet, or basically asserting, you know, one of the fundamental points of Mormon doctrine, that Mormons obey the prophet. And yeah. On the other hand, I guess people took offense, and maybe they took offense, and I saw a few comments in this regard, maybe they took offense because in a way you disagreed with a devout Mormon's decision to follow the prophet on this issue. And so you were kind of making that point in a way, you know, some interpreted it as a way to expose or embarrass people for following too blindly, maybe, or for not being honest in the campaign. Well, tease out for us where your heart or where your feelings were, you know, when you made that final assertion.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think my letter says that. I think people are reading into that. What I do think my letter says, and especially there are two versions of my letter. I want to set the record straight. No editor at the Daily Universe ever changed my letter. What happened is I'd sent in an original form of it, which had been rejected for publication. And when I was contacted, and they told me that they would like to publish it, and not just as a letter to the editor, but as a viewpoint, I decided to look over my letter again to make sure, you know, that there weren't any errors or like gross grammatical problems. And I decided to add a sentence that kind of clarified my position. And what ended up happening is that the original letter was published and not my revised version that I had actually submitted to be published as the viewpoint. So there wasn't any going through my letter with a black pen or a black marker. That didn't happen. But what I do think I can say is that I don't think that this is an issue that someone has thought about, that someone has done their duty to society if they haven't thought deep and hard about these issues. I think the problem is that there's a balance. There's a balance between your commitment and your responsibility to your religion and your religious leaders, and your commitment to other people who are not of your faith. And if this isn't a tug of war for you, then maybe you're being too extreme. If there's no give and take there, because I think as American citizens, we all understand, I think it's very easy to put yourself in someone else's shoes on this issue. That if we were told all of a sudden by a different religious group that something we did was incorrect, we would tend to want to ask them why they thought it was incorrect. And if it was something that was purely religiously motivated, I don't think it would convince us. And I think that's exactly what we were asking of society, and especially the gay community. I mean, there should be no surprise that this has been responded to the way it has by the gay community. This issue is very important to them. I think the issue of your family and your ability to marry, it's not just one of the issues they stand for like it is for many Mormons. This isn't our life. It doesn't affect our daily life, but it does for gays and lesbians who want to be married and have all the same rights as heterosexual couples. Now, in California, I understand that they had most of those rights. I do think in the trial, there were some things that were shown where people were treated differently legally under civil unions than they would be with the classification of marriage. And so I do think that those things matter to gays and lesbians.
Right. Okay. Well, what I'd like to do, I'm going to just give a cue to our listeners that I think we're ready to start taking calls. And that means that my buddy Richard is going to be sending out a phone line that people can call. But I also want to invite people to call in on Skype at the address Mormon Stories. Richard's going to be taking those calls and screening them and getting them ready. So I just want to cue our listeners that we're ready to start taking calls. And once they get filtered through Richard, we'll be bringing them on the line. So before we do that, and that's given Richard a little bit of time. Oh, the phone number is 435-915-4429. That's 435-915-4429. I'd like to encourage you guys to call in, or you can Skype us at Mormon Stories. So, Carrie, one of the big questions that people asked is, what was the response at BYU for writing that article?
The response at BYU was mainly silence. The letter was removed shortly after being published, and I never heard anything from the administration. I emailed the editor who I had initially submitted my letter to, and she didn't really have much to tell me. She wasn't part of the decision to remove it. She did tell me that she hadn't received any discipline. I myself haven't received any discipline as well. I haven't heard from the university. As far as I know, we are still good friends. As far as students at BYU, it surprises me. I've definitely received some feedback, most of it positive and most of it from friends or people who already knew me. There have been a few people who've just added me on Facebook and, you know, given me a little thumbs up for what I was willing to say. I haven't received any direct communication that in the form of negative feedback. I haven't received, any hate mail. I've definitely seen some on blogs where people comment on my letter, and I've received some indirectly from people close to me, and I've mainly just been able to call them and talk to them about it, and it's gone very well. My main response came from outside the BYU community, from people all over Utah at first and then all over the country. And most of it was very favorable. Before the letter was pulled, people's main response was, wow, that took a lot of courage. And I can't believe BYU would publish this. And I think it's a good sign for the freedom of expression in the church. And then the Daily Universe removed the letter. And that quickly was reversed.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. somebody forwarded me the link to the to your editorial, and my immediate reaction was, I'm going to Facebook this because it's so awesome that BYU would allow a letter like this to go. It's like, oh, a breath of fresh air. We're opening things up. We're letting diverse opinions. You know, the whole basic sentiment that was behind the Mormon.org PR campaign, where we're a church that embraces diversity and that embraces individuality. It was like a follow-on from that, where it felt like, here's the church, you know, living by what it seems to be promoting in its PR campaign. So I was thrilled. And I swear, it wasn't 2 hours from when I posted that on Facebook that it was yanked down. And it just seems so embarrassing to the church, because something that would have just been a blip and maybe even favorable ends up maybe potentially being yet another black eye. Does anybody in the panel have any thoughts on that decision by BYU? Any insight into it? Any perspective?
I need to say something. I think they've been, the Daily Universe has been pretty adamant about taking responsibility for this. Obviously, it could have come from somewhere else, but as far as I know, it was just one faculty member, the head editor at the Daily Universe, who initially approved the letter, and then as they received a response, he decided to take it off. There's no real evidence that the BYU administration or the LDS church at large were involved at all.
Right, so maybe it was...
Well, go ahead, let me just say, I obviously no one knows why, but to me it's strange credulity to think that the Daily Universe decided to take it down because a few students complained about it. Somebody complained that was in a position of authority, and yes, it was the Daily Universe that took the fall for it, but who called the editor of the Daily Universe that had so much clout that he would make the decision, which seems to me to be a terrible decision from a public relations point of view, to take the letter down? I kind of agree with John. This was an opportunity missed, an opportunity for the church to say, look, on our campus at BYU, we do have academic freedom. We have freedom of speech. We can speak our mind on things without, and in a respectful manner, without repercussions. And I think Carrie's letter was very respectful. So, I was disappointed.
Yeah. Okay, were you going to speak up, Morris?
Nope.
I have something to say. I've been watching the Daily Universe for any viewpoints or letters to the editor about my letter, and none of them, there has been none. I know of at least 20 people who've told me that they've written into the Daily Universe a letter to the editor. So it seems like that story is going to die. I don't think it's going to be commented on in the Daily Universe soon. It seems to me that they are not allowing any subsequent letters to the editor to be published.
John, this is...
Go ahead, Laura.
I was a journalism major in college, and I think that the Daily Universe staff are learning a very hard lesson, but maybe one that they're getting the wrong lesson from, that by stopping the conversation, you're able to dodge the hard conversations. And that's just not what newspapers should be doing. And I think that by having the faculty step in and say, yeah, let's pull this, let's not have any more letters to the editor because something was offensive, I think that that's sending the wrong message to these people who are going to be out and become the future muckrakers and PR folks of the world. I think that they've really dropped the ball on that as journalism faculty and as student editors. But, like, you know, it's a student newspaper and they're learning, so hopefully they'll learn a lesson.
Well, the other thing that I think we're learning is that this is not your grandmother's Daily Universe, and it's not your grandmother's world, and or your grandfather's. When something like this happens, it instantly goes all over the world, as Carrie has pointed out. I don't know how they thought they were somehow going to bury this thing. Does no one else on BYU campus have internet access and can read all these blogs and can tune into Mormon Stories? the discussion's going to happen. It's just not going to happen in the moderated setting of the universe.
Yeah, Yeah, it's a little bit crazy. It's. I mean, I guess there's a chance that the church has just decided that it gets, you know, let's just say that there's some committee at the top of church leadership that has to decide whether or not it's going to intervene. You know, we know that, like, with the September 6th, that high-level leaders got in trouble for intervening in local matters in the stakes where the members of the September 6th were participating. And I've always gotten the sense that from September 6th on, top church leaders have tried to avoid the appearance that they're mingling in local decisions and in, you know, local affairs. And so there's always a chance that these top-level leaders are basically saying, we can't get in the business of censoring the BYU newspaper, so we have to just let whatever happens, happens. And then, Laura, kind of like you said, the editors and the student, you know, participants are just scared. They don't want to bring shame on the church. And in reality, this doesn't reflect at all on decisions made by the church leadership. True?
I think that's true. I want to hear what this caller has to say.
All right, caller. Welcome to Mormon Stories.
Hi, John. Laura, Morris, Carrie, this is really fantastic that you guys are doing this tonight. I'm really enjoying this conversation.
Wait, is this Tom Grover?
Is this Tom Grover? Yeah, this is Tom Grover.
What's up, Tommy? He's calling from Nebraska.
That's right. Yeah, out here on the plains.
All right, brother, go ahead.
I guess, Mike, I've got a couple of questions for Carrie. And the first is, you had this letter. It's been censored, as you have discussed. You don't know by who. And yet here you are on Mormon Stories, continuing to speak out on the issue of marriage equality, but also the censorship. And I'm wondering, do you fear any kind of retribution, either formally from the church or socially from people who find out that you're continuing to speak out?
I have definitely been anxious. I haven't been able to really give my schooling my best effort the last week. And I'm it's taken a little toll on me. I'm nervous about a lot of blogs have made comments to the point of, oh, it's too bad this kid's going to get excommunicated and kicked out of BYU. I don't really think that's going to happen. BYU does say in the honor code, the honor code doesn't just limit behavior. It does limit expression on some points. And one of those points is that you're not allowed to advocate homosexual behavior as morally acceptable. You're not allowed to make that statement. And I've definitely had to be very aware of that as I've gone into interviews. As I've continued to talk, I don't think my initial letter would cause negative disciplinary action from the church or from BYU. I do think as I continue to do interviews, that there's a possibility that I could say something that would put me in jeopardy of losing my place at BYU. And that's definitely not an outcome that I'm looking forward to happening if it does. I do also feel like, as before I agree to any interview, I try to make sure that my goals, I have a few goals as to why I would write the letter and as to why I would do more interviews. And I try to make sure that the interview could satisfy one of those goals, that it's not just about attention and that it's not about anyone else's goals for me or my letter. Socially, I don't anticipate I'll lose many friends over this. The Facebook battle has been in my favor. I probably gained 50 more friends than I've lost. So it's going to be all right socially.
Real quick, and then I want to bring Tom back in if he's still on the line. But Carrie, do you get a sense that at BYU there's a general antipathy for gay rights or a lot of sympathy for gay rights at BYU?
It's a hard question because I think at BYU you can find people who agree with you and you tend to hang out with those people. Amongst my group of friends, I know many people who are in support of homosexual rights. I think homosexual rights in general is becoming a more, I mean, it's obviously a very, it's almost a mainstream Mormon stance. It is a mainstream Mormon stance to say that you believe in homosexual rights. I think the church made that clear with its ordinance. It was, it helped support pass in Salt Lake. There's a similar ordinance being discussed in Provo, and there's a meeting on actually tomorrow night at the BYU Law Building where people can go and show their support and find out what they need to do to help that ordinance pass. I think that in a class, depending on which department you're in, I don't think in the religion department you would be wise to express your favor for homosexual or any sort of deviant opinion about Proposition 8. If you're in sociology, if you're in an English class, maybe. I mean, it really depends on the professor, I think. A lot of students have a lot of respect for their professors and can kind of get a feel for how the class is being run and what there is appropriate to say.
Right. So it just depends, but you definitely have a core group of friends that are supportive of gay rights at BYU.
Yes. Yes. I'd say that I could at least round up 10 people within an hour.
Right. Okay. Well, Tom, you still on the line?
Yeah, I am.
Oh, Tom, did you have a second question or follow-up?
Yeah, just a second question, if you guys don't mind. Okay. This is also for Carrie. But I joined the conversation late, so if you've already answered this, just skip it and go ahead. So in the explanation that the Daily Universe gave, they used the word offensive to describe your column. And that was attributed not to the Daily Universe finding it offensive, but the readership. And I'm wondering, from your personal perspective, if you felt that stung a little bit, that felt that was kind of a sanction against you personally, if you will.
The word offensive, it definitely made me go back and read my article. I wanted to know what people found offensive. My intent was never to offend people. I don't think my letter is offensive. I think what it could possibly do, I understand that a lot of people in California sacrificed a lot to get Proposition 8 passed, that this wasn't a casual thing for them, that a lot of people lost close relationships with family members or friends, that they spent money, that they spent time. And to any challenge to its validity, I think, because they're so invested, could cause them to feel offended. I think our church is pretty clear. We've had a few talks now that being offended is a choice, that people don't offend you, that you choose to be offended. And I thought it was very interesting that that was the word used to describe my article, that I had offended people.
Yeah. Yeah, I even had I have a wonderful aunt who's got to be in her 70s, who's in no way, antagonistic to the church. She's very faithful. She wrote me and said on Facebook, "John, can you please explain to me what was offensive about that BYU editorial?"
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I think we're all confused about that. So I want to invite listeners. This may seem like a panel and a discussion that would not be hospitable to people who are supporters of Proposition 8 and people who are opposed to gay marriage or very supportive of the Daily Universe. And I want to invite any caller to please call in if you support Proposition 8, if you support the BYU Daily Universe's decision. I promise that we'll be friendly and non-antagonistic, and this will be a warm and a safe environment to disagree and to express your opinion. So, again, anyone who wants to call in and share that, you are welcome. Laura, you've been quiet for a bit. Do you have any thoughts or comments you want to throw in from what we've talked about
so far? I've been kind of watching the chat. I see here that somebody has asked if Morris has noticed any members leaving the church over Prop 8 or if he's seen any wards divided. I know that I've kind of seen both, that people have left, and I've kind of seen people step away from... I've seen both, and I've anecdotally heard of other people. I'm not sure that anybody's joined because of our stance on Prop 8, but I think I have heard of people saying that.
Morris?
Well, I too have run across a number of people who found this to be divisive. I know people who are staying away from church because they're very hurt by this. I know people who've resigned their membership in the church because of Prop 8. There are a lot. I received emails from people after my six consequences. Someone explained in detail in an email how they had come to the same conclusion concerning six consequences even before they'd read what I wrote, talked to their bishop and stake president about it, and they forwarded their thoughts up the line, but it didn't go any further up the line. Later, their bishop acknowledged, their stake president acknowledged that he didn't send it up because it would just come back, and they treated the whole argument against the six consequences as more or less of an annoyance and an irritant. And she says, this was a woman who wrote me, her husband was in the bishopric. She said, my husband writes a letter of resignation every Sunday, but so far hasn't sent it. And they kind of asked me what I thought. And basically what I said is, don't send it.
Right.
You need to be able to stay. If you feel the way you feel, you need to be able to stay and express it. And there's a lot of good that the church does, and it's not worth, in his situation, it didn't seem like it was worth resigning from the church.
Right. And I'll just add anecdotally, we have a caller waiting, but I'll add anecdotally that I've requested essays for a book that we're working on called Why People Leave the LDS Church. And dozens and dozens of people that I've spoken with have either resigned their membership of the church or gone inactive or lost their faith over Proposition 8. So anecdotally, I know dozens, if not, over 100 people who this has affected very seriously. But let's go to a caller.
Hey, John.
Hey, right. Who's this?
This is Glenn.
Welcome, Glenn.
How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Good. Thanks for getting me on. I wanted to address Morris Thurston about his response to the 6 points, and specifically the first point about education. I read that, and I read the conclusion that he proposed as a response, and while I don't disagree with the conclusion, I kind of disagree with the way he got there.
Okay.
And Morris, you were talking about how the California Education Code would not require teachers to teach, but we have this issue with the teacher who brought her first grade class to San Francisco to witness her own marriage. And I'm just wondering, how did the California Education Code restrict her from doing that?
Well, that's a good question, actually, and I appreciate you bringing that up. First of all, that you have to go behind the facts there just a little bit. This was a woman, a gay teacher, in a, as I understand it, Laura can correct me if I'm wrong, a private school.
It was either private school. It might have been a charter school.
Okay, a charter school.
But it was, and the kids had known the teacher. This is the second year that those kids were with that teacher. And it was a small school, so everybody knew the teacher and knew that's an important part.
And also, I think that the teacher...
During time, that's correct.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
I said the outing was done during school time?
Yeah, if
Yeah, it was permission slips from the parents.
They got permission slips from the parents, and my understanding is that it wasn't a case of just busing the entire class or taking them there, but rather the one who wanted to go. And I think they took public transportation, actually, to go there.
And it was a surprise. The teacher didn't know that it was going to happen. The parents kind of set it up and said, let's all go see your teacher.
It just seems to me like that is an anomaly. You're always going to find, you know, the one person who has a book on gay marriage or does something that's kind of out of the ordinary. But none of that is required by the law. And that was my point about that it actually said that the law would require teachers to teach about gay marriage.
Right, and the California Education Code would not be changed by Proposition 8. That part of your conclusion, I completely agree with. It would not. But in an LA Times article, October 19, 2008, there was a paragraph in there that said there is nothing in the state education code that requires schools to teach anything about marriage. Even the decision about whether to offer comprehensive sex education is left up to the individual school districts. So there seems to be in the education code a lot of leeway in terms of making decisions about what will be part of the curriculum or what won't be part of the curriculum.
I think that's right. And I think that the parents have a lot of input into that.
Sure they do. And so the point is, while there won't be any requirement to teach about gay marriage being equal to traditional marriage, there's no restriction on it either.
But Glenn, there is a requirement, though, that when students are taught about marriage, that there is as much respect for domestic partnerships as there is for man-woman marriage, as there is for divorced parents, that the schools can't say this marriage is good and this domestic partnership is bad. They are equal ways of treating your family. And the school would not be able to say same-sex marriage is bad and gay marriage is good. And certainly they're not going to be talking to kindergartners and first graders about how to have gay sex.
Okay. That's understood about the sexual relation part and so forth. But as far as the word marriage is concerned, if Proposition 8 is struck down and we go back to a situation in California where gay marriage is legal, then as an educator, as a teacher, when I'm in the classroom and I'm teaching a concept, I need to define the terms. If same-sex marriage is legal, I'm not necessarily going to use the term same-sex marriage. All of a sudden, the term marriage becomes legal and applicable to men marrying men, women marrying women, and men and women marrying each other. Is that not correct?
Well, I think, obviously that's true. If the issue that people are worried about is that students are going to learn about same-sex marriage in the sense of that there is such a thing, you're absolutely right. Obviously, if there is same-sex marriage, people are going to learn about it. Of course, my reaction to that or response to that is that every young person in my ward knows about same-sex marriage because they stood out on street corners holding signs against it. So they're not learning anything they didn't already know.
And I can also say, as a parent of children in school, that every child, every class in my school has at least one gay couple as parents. It's not like it's something that kids don't know about. They already know that it's there. It's just the adults saying, oh, yeah, it's here.
Right. You know, one last point, Morris, on your response in talking about how Prop 8 affects California Education Code and so forth. Would you not agree with the statement that a law today may not be the same law tomorrow? In other words, there are groups out there that are working very hard to get the vote that affirmed Proposition 8 overturned in the courts. Once that's done, I believe that those same groups are going to go after the California Education Code and get that changed so that marriage is defined as, you know, what I said before, that it's a man can marry a man, a woman can marry a woman, and a man and woman, that all of that equals the word marriage.
Oh, I think that's certainly the impact of this. There's no question about that. But again, I don't see that. I mean, you have to say that what you want to have happen is that no one will mention the fact that people are getting married, and they are. They're going to mention it. If that's the law, that's what's going to happen. I agree with you.
Okay. Yeah, that was my whole point. I felt like there was another dimension to your argument that was missing, and once the word marriage becomes, you know, has the full force of the state behind it as applying to all of these different situations, then the effort to then go and change the California Education Code will be a very strong one by those proponents of the gay lifestyle and so forth. And so I think what it does is once the full force of the state is behind that word, then it opens up the box to all of these other things that then become part of the public education system for right or wrong, and opens up a huge can of worms.
Well, I guess I agree with everything you said, but I don't worry about the can of worms because, to me, as Laura pointed out, kids have already got parents of other kids in their class who are of the same sex. I don't see a problem in people knowing there is such a thing, are such a thing as homosexuals, and that there is homosexual attraction, and that some people have elected to make their relationships long-term relationships. In fact, I would hope that would be a good thing. I don't think this can of worms involves or includes educators, teachers, and others recruiting children to become gay. I just don't believe that at all.
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily the issue that I'm getting at. I mean, if you look at the Lexington, Massachusetts case, where basically the parents of the child were told, you know, don't interfere with what we're teaching your children, and that's my paraphrase. It really gets to be a sticky situation as to how much influence parents can have over the education process, especially when they're paying the taxes for that education, and then they're told by the courts or by the school district, no, you cannot have any say in what we teach your children. And that's getting to the can of worms that I'm referring to. But just for the record, I will state for myself and my own personal beliefs that I'm all for civil unions, domestic partnerships, and so forth. I think, you know, I fall in the camp with Elton John over this word marriage, that, you know, we've had this distinct traditional definition of it, and if we can provide all of the rights afforded to same-sex individuals under civil unions or domestic partnerships, then why can't we leave this word marriage alone? And I believe that it has a lot to do with the legal issues that come with having the full force of the state behind that word.
Right.
Can I say one more thing about this?
Sure.
At our website, when we were talking about marriage and why it should be equal and why it should be allowed, we had a teenager write in on a comment saying that she has no reason to. She was talking with her friends and they were talking about virginity and not having premarital sex. And then she said, "But if I can't get married, why should I remain a virgin? Why should I not be promiscuous if I don't have a reason to stop being promiscuous? If I can't save myself from my future spouse?" I think one thing that if we have this marriage option, and teenagers and children growing up in school realize that they can, that they have this option, whether they're gay or straight, that maybe we'll see a downturn on some of the promiscuous and unhealthy sex attitudes that we have seen in especially young gay males in the last decades.
Right.
Well, one other final thought on that issue too that was brought up, because I think it was, you know, it's a well thought out, well reasoned issue. You're always going to have at the margins somebody who does something that people aren't going to agree with, and you can bet that if it happens, if something that is outrageous to somebody happens, it's going to get publicized all over the world. And the miracle to me, the amazing thing is that all we have is this incident in Massachusetts and this field trip in California where everybody consented, and nothing else. That, to me, is not really a can of worms. The incident in Massachusetts, I've talked to people who live in Massachusetts now, and this thing is, you know, they've had gay marriage for quite some time now. And most people just yawn and say, life goes on as normal. There is no horror story. I heard those same horror stories back when we opposed the Equal Rights Amendment for women, about all the horrible things that would happen, like, oh, women might be required to join the military, and they might actually fight in battles. And here we have today women doing exactly that, and we don't care.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Well, Glenn, make one last comment. We got a bunch of callers, so make a quick comment, then we got to go on.
Her example. And I, you know, when the church released God loveth his children, I think it created a problem for the church as it relates to this very issue, because the position of the church shifted slightly away from the old paradigm into a new way of thinking about homosexuality in general. And I think that for the church to deny people the opportunity to practice something that they have no control over, as I believe the church is now hinting at in that pamphlet, in that document, is two-faced at a minimum, and I believe is going to, if people take that document seriously, I believe that's going to create some problems for the church, where people will say, how can you deny people who you've admitted don't have control over these feelings the opportunity to express those because they come from an orientation that's different from the norm?
Right. All right, Glenn, I don't want to cut you off, but you've been a great participant. Thank you so much for calling in.
You bet. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Glenn. Yeah, I mean, I think I know how the church would answer that. I'm giving Richard a chance to bring on the next caller. But I think that the church would say, yeah, you can't control your feelings, but you sure can't control your behavior, right?
Elder Oaks and Elder Wickman say that in their interview that they had with a public affairs official about same-sex attraction. They say that exact thing. And they say it's the exact same thing they ask of old single members of the church who never get married. I mean, it's debatable as to whether those things are similar or the same thing, but I think that has been a response in the past.
Yeah, and I'll just add that I know people who feel like they're able to live a celibate life, and I know people for whom that seems like a sad, desperate impossibility. So, you know, I tried to pin down Bruce Bashan and Carolyn Pearson to condemn that option of people living in solitude, and they were, both of them did not want to do that. They wanted to say, you know, everyone's got to make their own decision. If that's something they feel good about, they need to be able to do that. My only issue is that I think there's a certain group of people, and probably the majority, for whom the option of a life of solitude is just desperately sad and you know, unhealthy. All right. Go ahead, Laura, and then we've got Greg on the line.
I want to hear from Greg.
Hi, Greg.
Hello.
Welcome to Mormon Stories.
Thank you. My comments are kind of back to some of Carrie's issues and some questions that stem from his article. First, I would kind of like to clarify with Carrie, because you asked for people who maybe disagree, as it were. I don't know if I disagree. I tend to more agree with what he's saying. However, he seems to kind of call out Mormons, or call it the general body of the church, for supporting Prop 8 because the prophet said so, and says that all these other reasons that were taken to court are not the reason that they're doing it. And while I think that now that those reasons have really been disproven or shown that they're not very valid, at the time they were voting, I still think it's very possible they indeed believed those things. I was wondering if there could be any clarification in that regard.
Sure. Thanks, Greg. I do think that people did believe those arguments. I know that my mom did at some point, and as we would talk about them, and I definitely didn't dismiss them. I thought, especially when they were repeated by, three of those arguments were repeated by Elder Cook in the broadcast that he was a part of to California members about Proposition 8. And I do definitely think that that is possible. What kind of convinces me, though, that those weren't the most important thing to people is that for many people that I've talked to who felt that those arguments were true at the time, now that they are seeing that they might not be, their stance hasn't changed in many cases. I definitely think that people may have maybe read Morris's document or have read the legal conclusion, which, by the way, I mean, the trials might be appealed. It probably will be appealed, and there might be new things brought to light. So we don't have to give up on those arguments completely. But I think that for many people, the fact that those arguments are being strongly challenged made no difference as to how much they supported Proposition 8. And to me, that shows the underlying reason was something other than those arguments. I heard John on his Facebook, he asked if the prophet came out in favor or against Proposition 8, would people have used these reasons and come to the conclusion that they needed to still vote for it? I think that's a good question, and it helps to highlight that standard as to whether or not people were really following the prophet first, or whether they were basing their decision off of these rational arguments.
Yeah, I just, you know, I don't want to oversimplify or take away. I think to be a traditional Orthodox believing Mormon is to sort of say, on matters doctrinal, on matters theological, and even on matters social and political, I think there's a good chunk of the membership that feel like they abdicate that thinking and that responsibility to church leadership and to what they feel is the prevailing culture. And I don't think there's any question that if the prophet made an about-face, the same people who fought to support Prop 8 would turn around and defeat it. And probably many of them wouldn't even feel any cognitive dissonance about it.
And John, I think some of them would be grateful. I know that I've talked with plenty of people who said, you know, I really don't see the problem with same-sex marriage, but the prophet is against it, and he must have a better understanding than I do. He must know better. His judgment, his sight is better than mine, so I'm going to submit my thoughts to his. I think if he changed his mind, they'd be like, oh, wow, yay. So I don't have to be in internal disagreement with what I'm doing.
So, Laura, you're saying you know people who maybe even strongly disagreed with Prop 8 but followed the prophet anyway?
Yes, because they thought the prophet was the prophet, and because they trusted his insight, just like when you trust the insight of a professor or somebody that you respect, and you say, well, I don't understand all the reasons, but this person that I admire who knows a lot has this idea, and I thought, well, maybe I'm just missing something, and he knows something that I don't know. Right. I think that's kind of information I heard.
Well, we saw the same thing happen with regard to blacks in the priesthood. There were an awful lot of people who simply breathed a huge sigh of relief, and that doctrine was changed. Now, there were a few who were invested in the old one and probably who had kind of a closet feeling still of a little bit of bigotry against blacks. But for the most part, people just pitched right in and said, great, changes here. Now we don't have to deal with all this question of why is this, and even, you know, even apostles like
Bruce R. McConkie.
You know, Bruce R. McConkie and said, you know, forget what I've said before. This is where we go.
Yeah.
And I think we have something, I think we have something closer to that with the Salt Lake City Ordinance. If you looked at public opinion polls before the church came out in favor of gay rights and housing and other and employment, the opinion, the approval of such an ordinance was very low. I don't have the statistics. Look them up. But afterwards, after the church issued that statement, it swung dramatically. People don't have 60, 70% change in public opinion because they come up with some great new rational reason as to why gays and lesbians should have those rights. It was because the church changed its policy, or they didn't change their policy. They came out and made a stance on that issue. I mean, they clarified their stance as to, in their support of a specific ordinance.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to discuss it with others, please check us out online at mormonstories.org. If you want to find other friends, family members, former missionary companions, or ward members who approach Mormonism like you, consider adding me, John DeLynn, as your Facebook friend. This may seem like a strange idea, but many of my closest friends have discovered that they are not alone in their thoughts or feelings or family or even a ward situation through discovering mutual Facebook friends. Finally, to keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider a donation at mormonstories.org. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton.